Welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about aspirin therapy. Now, for years, we've known that patients with diabetes are less responsive to aspirin therapy, at least in terms of their response to platelet aggregation studies, and thus some patients exhibit aspirin resistance and appear to require larger doses to achieve a therapeutic benefit. There are probably several factors that lead to aspirin resistance, but one factor that has not been extensively explored is the dosage form. A recent study published in February 2017 in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology evaluated several different aspirin formulations, and the results were a bit surprising. At least they were surprising to me. Joining me today are Rob Howe and Daniela Valencia from the VA Medical Center in West Palm Beach, Florida. Dr. Howe is a clinical pharmacy specialist and the PGY2 Cardiology Pharmacy Residency Program Director, and has been a frequent contributor to iFormRx. And he's joined by Dr. Valencia, who is currently a PGY1 Pharmacy Practice Resident. They wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled "Peeling Back the Layers of Coated Aspirin." Rob, Daniela, thank you for joining me today for the iFormRx podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Stuart. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
So, Daniela, let me start with you. If you had to briefly summarize, in four sentences or less, the study entitled "Enteric Coating and Aspirin Non-Responsiveness in Patients with Type 2 Diabetes," to someone who hasn't read the paper, what would you say?
The article was a three-day pharmacokinetics pharmacodynamics study with the purpose of looking at aspirin non-responsiveness in 35 individuals with obesity, type 2 diabetes, and no history of cardiovascular disease. And the authors choose to study patients with obesity and diabetes, as this has been independently linked to reduced rates of aspirin responsiveness. Those patients with cardiovascular disease were excluded, as there is an ethical component, as there was washout period in between aspirin trials. They used laboratory measurements of thromboxane B2 levels to compare the different aspirin 325 milligram formulations, including a new lipid base, PL2200, plain aspirin, and enteric-coated aspirin. And what the authors found was that the rate of aspirin non-responsiveness was similar for the PL2200 and plain aspirin at 8% and 16% respectively, but it was much higher for the enteric-coated aspirin at 53%. And this was a significant difference, as it represents a high proportion of individuals compared to the other two aspirin formulations.
Now, Daniela, I'm wondering what concerns you may have regarding the study design and its analysis. Are there any major threats to the internal or external validity of the study?
Overall, it was a well-designed study. They admitted patients for aspirin administration, and this allows to remove non-compliance as a confounding factor. As we know, it can have significant impact on aspirin responsiveness. Also, in terms of internal validity, they included only patients who had diabetes and obesity, which allowed to control the effect of these conditions on aspirin response.
And while those things are good, I think that also raises some concerns about the external validity of this study, however, especially with the inclusion of only diabetics and obese patients. While this does allow us to focus more on the aspirin dosing formulations themselves, it does hinder the external generalizability to a broader population. Also, they did look at a single dose of aspirin at 325 milligrams and only 3 days. The first component of this being the aspirin dose that was used may limit the external generalizability, as the majority of patients are treated with a dose of 81 milligrams. So what this really means for clinical practice is largely unknown. However, we do have evaluations looking at low-dose chewable versus enteric-coated aspirin that show the same type of trends in thromboxane generation levels, suggesting that the data that we have here in this trial with enteric-coating leading to lower responsiveness rates could more than likely be cautiously applied to lower dose as well. One of the final things that we talk about is that the trial was based on thromboxane B2 generation. So obviously we know nothing about actual cardiovascular endpoint rates within the trial. And we're largely relying on surrogate measure here to tell us about the effects. The authors did use a cutoff of 99% for thromboxane inhibition as their level for aspirin effectiveness. And there really is no standardization across trials of where this level should really be. Other trials use 95 to 97%. But at this point, it's kind of the best measure that we have to use as far as a surrogate for response rates. We really need to get a trial that's adequately powered for actual cardiovascular event rates to really determine if these findings on the surrogate thromboxane generation levels actually have any clinical impact.
So it's not uncommon for patients to use enteric-coated aspirin for either primary or secondary prevention of MI or stroke, and many patients purchase enteric-coated aspirin over the counter. It's frequently prescribed, and it's even covered by health plans. Based on my own experience at the VA, I suspect that low-dose enteric-coated aspirin is the most frequently prescribed and dispensed antiplatelet drug. Enteric-coated aspirin has been favored because it purportedly has a gastroprotective effect. Do the data support the contention that enteric-coated aspirin is safer? And if not, given the results of this study and others, should we continue to prescribe and dispense enteric-coated aspirin?
Anecdotally, from my own practice, I would see exactly what you saw historically here in the VA, Stuart, is that the majority of patients that we have coming into clinic are treated with enteric-coated aspirin. Now, whether that matters clinically is a real difference. Now, with that being said, when we think of the safety issues, this is kind of one of those marketing ploys that has probably made somebody a whole lot of money. When we look at the actual rates of GI bleeding and actual safety endpoints, there's actually really no data to support that there's any benefit or safety benefit afforded with the use of enteric-coated aspirin. Actually, in the most recent United States Preventive Service Task Force statement regarding the use of aspirin in primary prevention of cardiovascular disease, they go as far as to have a statement that says there is no evidence that enteric-coated or buffered formulations reduce the risk of serious GI bleeding with regards to aspirin use. So really, when you look in total at this point in the study, given the fact that there's a suggestion of even based on surrogate risk that perhaps patients may not garner as much benefit from enteric-coated aspirin, albeit again on a surrogate endpoint, the fact that there's no safety benefit afforded with that, you know, my impression would be that regular plain aspirin should be the preferred formulation. And like you said, and many of these patients do get the formulations over the counter, and they do see words like safety coated.
And I wanted to share something that I thought it was interesting. I was yesterday at my local community pharmacy and looked at the aspirin shelves, and about 30%, only 30% of the aspirin was chewable formulation. So most of the other aspirin products were enteric-coated or the safely coated aspirin. So in terms of when patients are going to buy aspirin over the counter, there's higher chance that they might get the enteric-coated compared to the chewable plain aspirin.
We're spending a lot of time talking about plain versus enteric-coated aspirin. Obviously, that's what's on the shelf at this point. But I think it's reasonable to give PL2200, the lipid-based formulation of aspirin, a little bit of due here. While we have not seen a benefit with enteric-coated aspirin versus plain aspirin on safety endpoints, there was a trust study looking at PL2200 versus plain aspirin and 7 days worth of dosing. And the authors did report rates of endoscopic identified erosions at 22% and 42% with the PL2200 versus plain aspirin formulation. So again, suggesting that there may be some benefit afforded with this PL2200 formulation of aspirin that we do not see with enteric-coated aspirin.
So I want you to imagine you're seeing a 74-year-old African-American male in diabetes clinic for insulin dose adjustments. In addition to hypertension and dyslipidemia, the patient is obese and has coronary artery disease for which he takes a beta blocker, an ACE inhibitor, a statin, and low-dose enteric-coated aspirin. The patient has been doing great. His last A1C was 6.8%. He's only had one symptomatic episode of hypoglycemia in the last 3 months. His home blood pressure readings are consistently below goal, and he reports no episodes of chest pain. His last lipid profile looks great. His LDL is less than 70, and he's on a target dose of a high-potency statin. Now, based on the results of this study, would you be inclined to switch this patient's aspirin therapy What dose would you use, 81 milligrams or 325? And would you consider using clopidogrel instead?
So there's a lot within that question. First part of the question is for this patient, regardless of whether it's early in therapy, late in therapy, whether he had PCI, CABG, whatever the situation as far as how his coronary artery disease has been treated, I think based on the results of the study, I think it would be perfectly reasonable to prefer a plain, uncoated aspirin for this patient. Now, with regards to aspirin dosing, particularly in diabetic patients, there is some, again, surrogate endpoint from thromboxane generation-based studies that suggest that perhaps diabetics fare better on higher doses of aspirin. However, when we actually look at endpoints or studies that have clinical endpoints, such as the current OASIS 7 study, which did look at high dose 325 versus low dose 81 milligram aspirin in patients who had recently had interventions, we saw that even in diabetic patients, there was no difference in actual cardiovascular event rates in the first 30 days or that highest risk period. So at this point, I think the low dose aspirin is perfectly reasonable based off the current OASIS 7 data. Now, the last question you ask is using clopidogrel instead of aspirin. So in this setting, let's assume that this is, you know, they're after 12 months after an intervention, you're moving to a single antiplatelet therapy. At this point, for the broad population, definitely aspirin is our mainstay cornerstone of therapy. What you allude to here in part is some data from the CAPRI study that historically looked at patients who were treated with aspirin 325 versus clopidogrel 75 milligrams a day in a numerous group of cohorts. And what they saw is there was a slight benefit with clopidogrel, but most practice organizations have said that the benefit offered there is not worth or not significant enough to actually favor the use of clopidogrel over aspirin when a single antiplatelet agent is being used.
Rob, Daniela, I want to thank you for joining us today to discuss aspirin resistance and patient responsiveness to various aspirin dosage forms. And it's clear from your comments that you believe that plain, uncoated aspirin should be preferred, that this study suggests that there may be a difference in benefits, and there is no evidence that enteric-coated aspirin provides a margin of safety. In light of this evidence, I'm wondering if we should be dropping enteric-coated aspirin from our formularies, from our shelves. Is there still a role for enteric-coated aspirin? Tell us what you think. Only iPharmRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iPharmRx. It's free. Sign up today. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iPharmRx, signing off.